roles that he needs to perform into muscle memory. Magazine changes, misfeed drills, weapons handling, and handcuffing are just a few of the many skills he must rehearse until he can perform these intricate tasks flawlessly, without conscious thought, even though he is in condition red. He might be in trouble if he is required to perform a fine motor skill that he has not rehearsed, but this is an acceptable risk. The optimal level of arousal. Screw your courage to the sticking place. Shakespeare, Macbeth. The linking of specific heart rate with task performance was pioneered by Bruce K. Siddle, author of the excellent book, Sharpening the Warrior's Edge, and one of the great pioneers in the field of warrior science. In 1997, I was asked to write the entry on psychological effects of combat and the Academic Press Encyclopedia of Violence, Peace, and Conflict. I asked Bruce Siddle to co-author the article with me because of the research he had conducted on the physiology of combat. We included the heart rate and performance chart with its thermometer scale in the article. World-class experts were asked to conduct a peer review of this encyclopedia entry. The reviews were all very supportive, and one even stated that this is brilliant. You can view this chart in the PDF included with this audiobook. Due to the nature of the double-blind peer review process, I'll probably never know the identity of this kind and generous reviewer. But the truth is that this research is not really brilliant. It is only an old soldier and an old cop asking questions that no one had asked before. The initial findings will continue to be updated and modified as new information becomes available. Today we can take this model a step further by integrating the color codes in the inverted U model, a classic universally accepted model of stress and performance, with Bruce Siddle's heart rate data, to form a unified model of stress and performance. It should be noted here that the color code system, which was popularized by Colonel Jeff Cooper, one of the greatest of the early pioneers in the field of warrior science, has always been a mental state rather than a physiological level. It is applied here with due apologies and full credit to its original developers. This graph can be viewed in the PDF included with this audiobook. The Gray Zone, Autopilot, and Stress Inoculation. I tell my men it's okay to be afraid. If I didn't think you had fear, I'd think twice about you. But it's learning how to operate with that fear and break through it and do your job as a professional. Command Sergeant Major Bob Gallagher, U.S. Army veteran of Somalia, on preparing his soldiers for the invasion of Iraq. Pete Pomerleau and Don Lazzarini are law enforcement instructors associated with the BAR Training Group, an organization that provides law enforcement training on a large scale. They have been replicating some of Bruce Siddle's research, in which heart rate monitors were attached to law enforcement officers engaged in highly stressful combat simulation training using paint bullets. These bullets hurt when they hit, which is desirable because pain and the possibility of pain makes this training a form of stress inoculation. We need more systematic research in this area, but the BAR research got the same results as Bruce Siddle. Pomerleau and Lazzarini found that when the average officer experiences a stress-induced, i.e. adrenaline-induced, heart rate increase in the area of 145 beats per minute, there is a significant breakdown in performance. But this is not true of everyone. Apparently, if you have practiced the required skills extensively, you can push the envelope of condition red, enabling extraordinary performance at accelerated heart rate levels. Let us call this zone roughly between 145 and 175 beats per minute, condition gray. Beyond condition gray is condition black, an area marked by catastrophic breakdown of mental and physical performance, which will be covered shortly. All of this research is still in its inception, an embryonic realm of fascinating new inquiry. Bruce Siddle writes in Warrior Science that The study of man's behavior in combat is a study of paradoxes, enigmas, and extremes. The combat experience is an intangible and hides in the deep recesses of the human psyche. Therefore, the combat experience is difficult to chart with scientific measurements, and even more difficult for the world of scholars and historians to enter. Condition gray, in particular, is a truly gray area, about which we need to do considerably more research. Ron Avery is a law enforcement trainer and a world-class competitive combat pistol shooter, starring in three highly successful instructional videos called Secrets of a Professional Shooter. Ron says that he functions at two levels during competition. When he is running and gunning, his heart rate is around 145 beats per minute. For the individuals in the law enforcement research conducted by Bruce Siddle, and in the bar research, 145 beats per minute represents a level at which performance begins to break down. But for Ron, this is his optimal level of arousal. He has pushed the envelope. He has rehearsed and trained, turning each action into muscle memory, permitting himself to function at an expert level in condition gray. This concept of muscle memory is also referred to as autopilot, which will be addressed in greater detail later. Ron Avery calls this process stress acclimatization, which is a good descriptive term. The fundamental concept is that prior success under stressful conditions acclimatizes you to similar situations and promotes future success. I use the psychological term inoculation to describe this process. Whatever we call it, there can be no doubt that it works. Ron puts it this way. With the proper training and requisite conditioning and practice, we can achieve skills that others think impossible. I think there is a whole realm of possibilities that we can teach and train warriors to do. Stress acclimatization is about measuring precise doses of stress, followed by waves of recovery, and then repeating these cycles very specifically. There must be time for adaptation to take place, and there must be enough training, repeated over time, to help it stick, as well as reinforcing the conditioning. My old boss at West Point, Colonel Jack Beach, PhD, always makes the point that emotions have at least three components: cognitive, physiological, and behavioral. An important part of what we achieve through stress inoculation is cognitive. The student's experience in training helps to take some of the surprise out of it when the real situation arises. Effective training also elevates the student's sense of confidence, which is another cognitive aspect of stress inoculation. The sense of personal effectiveness and self-confidence created by realistic training is as much a stress reducer as when the muscles go on autopilot. As the Duke of Wellington put it, no man fears to do that which he knows he does well. Taking the surprise out of combat, raising the sense of confidence, and cognitively preparing the warrior for battle is one of the primary objectives of this audiobook. Thus, this audiobook can be seen as a form of stress inoculation, and the reduction in surprise and the increase in confidence it provides will hopefully reduce the stress of combat. Throughout this audiobook, I will focus on the physiological and behavioral aspects of preparing for combat, but we should always keep in mind these cognitive aspects. There is evidence to indicate that world-class experts in top physical condition under specific controlled situations can use autopilot and stress inoculation to push the envelope of condition red high into the gray zone. For example, one report in Popular Science magazine says that top NASCAR and Formula One drivers generally maintain a heart rate of around 175 beats per minute for hours on end. Using what we know from other realms of research involving performance under stress, we can hypothesize that these race car drivers have a limited set of skills, turn left, turn right, accelerate, brake, that has been extensively rehearsed and needs to be performed with extraordinary speed. Thus, the best of the best among these drivers appear to be pushing themselves, pushing the envelope of their personal condition red up to the outer edge of the gray zone. In 2001, as part of a comprehensive 2-week combatives instructor course, a U.S. Army Special Forces Green Beret officer, in conjunction with Dr. C.A. Morgan of the Yale Center for PTSD, and Gary Haslett, a U.S. Army Special Operations psychologist, conducted heart rate variability research on some of our nation's most elite warriors. Due to the rigorous and demanding course of instruction, this select group of Special Forces soldiers was already at an exceptionally high level of physical fitness. Thanks to many years of hard physical training and extensive combat skills development, they essentially have become world-class combat athletes. The primary instructor designed and conducted a force-on-force close-quarter battle stress test. Having to rely upon a combination of urban warfare and hand-to-hand combat skills, each Green Beret individually engaged trained role players who wore Blauer high-gear impact reduction suits and acted out varying levels of compliance. While wearing full combat equipment and using simunition paint bullet-equipped firearms for lethal force, as well as full contact empty hand skills for non-lethal situations, the Green Berets were assaulted with an overwhelming noise stimulus and a poorly lit macabre environment. At one point in the event, and completely without warning, a controller produced a significant pain stimulus with an electric shock to the upper body of each participant replicating hits from enemy gunfire. Despite these extraordinarily challenging circumstances, all of these warriors performed superbly. Looking only at maximum heart rates is a gross oversimplification of the complex subject of heart rate variability. But it is interesting to note that those who performed best had maximum heart rates near 175 beats per minute, while those who were marginally less proficient had maximum heart rates around 180 beats per minute. Like our NASCAR drivers, 175 beats per minute seems to be the optimal level of performance. And even at that level, their physical condition and their extensive training provided the stress inoculation and the autopilot responses that permitted them to push the condition red envelope to the outer extent of condition gray. There were, however, exceptions. After every engagement, the Green Berets were required to restrain each role player, whether dead or subdued in hand-to-hand combat, with flex cuffs, a type of flexible handcuff consisting of a narrow plastic strip with a small one-way hole on one end. The opposite, running end, is inserted into the hole and can then be tightened. Smaller versions are sometimes used to tie off plastic garbage bags. Inserting the end of the restraint into that little hole takes a relatively high level of fine motor control, a process that had not been rehearsed extensively by the Green Berets. The result was that the individuals who had not pre-threaded their flex cuffs, as they had been taught, had significantly more difficulty when it came to performing cuffing procedures under extremely high stress. Some were, at times, visibly unable to thread the cuffs and subsequently did not adequately restrain the subjects. The soldiers who properly prepared their cuffs performed the skill on autopilot and were able to simultaneously cuff and scan their environment. When learning skills and ingraining them as muscle memory or autopilot responses, it is important that only one way be taught. W.E. Hicks' 1952 study found that as the possible responses increased from 1 to 2, reaction time increased by 58%. In other words, Having to choose between options takes time, and the more options you have, the greater the reaction time. This is often referred to as Hicks' Law. But Sun Tzu said the same thing many centuries ago. The more possibilities you present to the enemy, the more diffuse he is forced to become. The more diffuse he becomes, the more difficult it is for him to concentrate sufficiently to make a successful attack. We want to confuse the enemy with a variety of possibilities, but we do not want to do that to ourselves. Thus, a simple set of skills, combined with an emphasis on actions requiring complex and gross motor muscle operations, as opposed to fine motor control, all extensively rehearsed, allows for extraordinary performance levels under stress. Leo Frankowski is a brilliant engineer with several patents and many successful science fiction books to his name. He and I have collaborated on several military science fiction novels. He says, on the walls of most engineering outfits, you will find a sign that says KISS, K-I-S-S. When a rookie asks what it is all about, he is told, keep it simple, stupid. This fundamental law of engineering also applies to training and preparing warriors for combat. There are many forms of stress inoculation. Firefighters are inoculated against fire. Soldiers are inoculated against sinking ships by placing them in compartments that flood with water as they fight to repair simulated damage. Many individuals are inoculated against heights through rappelling and rock climbing experiences. Every warrior organization should coordinate with the local police canine unit or a patrol dog company to see if the organization's members can put on the appropriate protective equipment and experience what it is like to be bit repeatedly by numerous attack dogs, preferably one at a time as opposed to all at once. My personal thanks to the Arizona Canine Association for permitting me to be bit by every dog in the state of Arizona in the prescribed manner. Gavin DeBecker's organization is the first warrior group I know of to incorporate this training for all of their personnel. They call it combat fear inoculation, in which every member of their team of elite bodyguards is required to participate. A true deranged killing rage can only be experienced and inoculated against in this manner, since trainees always know that a rational trainer will not intentionally commit an act that will seriously injure them. But an attack dog will, quite happily. Reacting calmly and rationally to fire, taking necessary and appropriate actions in situations involving heights, and dealing effectively with an attacking dog are examples of skills that save lives, but they are not the hardest thing that warriors are called upon to do. These are bad enough, but warriors must also move toward the sound of the guns, toward the most cunning, ingenious, destructive creature on the face of the earth, one of their own species, trying to kill them. As we have demonstrated, for most human beings, this is the universal human phobia. So how do you inoculate someone against a gunfight? As we will see later, warriors can and must be inoculated against this stressor by experiencing force-on-force scenarios in which they shoot and are shot at by paint-filled, gunpowder-propelled plastic bullets. When I trained the Singapore Special Operations Forces, they referred to these as pain bullets, an appropriate name. Stress inoculation is not perfect, and to get a useful degree of protection, it has to be precisely applied. Last year's flu vaccine is of limited value this year. A smallpox inoculation provides little protection against yellow fever, and a firefighter's inoculation against fire is of little value if people shoot at him. Yet, there does appear to be a transfer or seepage in the area of stress inoculation. Just as learning one language makes it easier to learn others, stress inoculation in one area makes it easier to quickly adapt to a new stressor. Paratroopers are stress-inoculated against parachuting out of an aircraft, thus making them elite troops who are better able to adapt quickly and fully to the demands of ground combat. There are many case studies that support the theory that the value of stress inoculation is not just inoculation against a specific stressor. There seems to be a kind of stress immune system, which permits you to get better and better at adapting to new stresses. A training officer in one major U.S. police department told me that they used a full-contact fighting champion to train their police. He was deeply respected and an extraordinarily competent hand-to-hand combat fighter. His level of stress inoculation in unarmed combat was off the scale. However, when they invited him to join them in a force-on-force paint bullet scenario, his skills in unarmed combat were of no use to him. In his first engagement, his heart rate shot up to over 200 beats per minute, and he dropped his gun. However, his previous stress inoculation allowed him to quickly adapt, and by the end of the day, he was performing superbly. This warrior must be respected and admired for his willingness to subject himself to the embarrassment of learning a new skill in front of others. There is no shame in failure. For a warrior, the only shame is in not trying. Using tactical breathing to stay in the zone. I will not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. Frank Herbert, Dune. Autopilot responses developed through repetitive practice and stress inoculation through realistic stressful training are two powerful and effective tools to push the envelope and stay in the zone. One additional tool to control physiological response is the tactical breathing exercise. Let us go back to Ron Avery and his performance as a professional shooter. When running and gunning in a pistol competition, his heart rate peaks around 145 beats per minute. But when he is standing and shooting, his heart rate stays around 90 beats per minute. He pulls himself down to condition yellow, like a sniper, taking calm precision shots. A good professional shooter functions at two levels, bouncing back and forth between condition yellow and condition red, or sometimes in a condition red that extends into the realm of condition gray. Something similar happens with professional basketball players. They are running up and down the court, functioning in high condition red, often pushing the envelope well into the gray zone, which is fine for that phase of the game. However, should a player stop and attempt to make a free throw, while his heart is pounding in his chest, he's going to throw a brick, a miss. Typically, a professional basketball player pauses for a moment before making a free throw and intuitively knows to take a few deep breaths. He uses all the time available to him to bring his heart rate down. He rolls his large shoulder muscles, consciously relaxes his body, and avoids looking at the crowd as he concentrates on his task. He intentionally pulls himself down into condition yellow, becoming a sniper in order to make the shot. Every basketball player intuitively understands that if he wants to make the free throw, he must switch back and forth between condition red and condition yellow. For those who don't push the envelope through physical fitness and repetitive training, condition gray is generally a realm in which complex motor skills begin to break down. One of the things that appears to be happening here is that bilateral symmetry begins to set in, meaning that what you do with one hand, you are likely to do with the other. For example, startle a baby, and both of its little arms and legs will jerk in what is known as the startle response, doing the exact same thing on both sides of the body. Bilateral symmetry can have grave consequences for a police officer in a tense situation where he is holding a pistol on a suspect. Say the suspect attempts to flee and the police officer grabs him with his free hand. Now, this is never a good tactical technique, and it is especially bad when the officer's heart rate is racing past 145 beats per minute. His accelerated heart rate causes bilateral symmetry. So as the officer grabs a fistful of the suspect's shirt with one hand, he has a convulsive clutch response in his gun hand, which causes an unintentional discharge of the weapon. This is my definition of a bad day for our police officer, and a very bad day for the suspect. Bilateral symmetry can also happen when you are startled. In an article titled, "The Impact of the Sympathetic Nervous System on Use of Force Investigations," Bruce Siddle writes, "Being startled while otherwise physically or mentally preoccupied will result in 4 involuntary actions occurring within 150 milliseconds. First, the eyes will blink. Second, the head and upper torso move forward. Third, the arms bend at the elbow. And lastly, the hands begin to tighten into fists. If a person is under extreme stress and adrenaline has been introduced into the system, the resulting startle response contraction of the hands can result in as much as 25 pounds of pressure. That amount of force is approximately twice the amount needed to discharge a double-action revolver. Now, there are many safeguards to prevent this convulsive clutch response. One is to keep the finger off the trigger until it is time to destroy the target, a technique that has become standard for military and law enforcement training. Even that is not a guarantee, since the clutch response can sometimes be so intense that the finger will slip back into the trigger guard, causing an unintentional discharge. My co-author told of being involved in a large brawl as a military policeman in Saigon. There were 6 enraged American soldiers and 5 or 6 MPs, and we were going at it hot and heavy all over the sidewalk, out into the street, and back onto the sidewalk again. At one point, one of the soldiers started to disarm one of the MPs, so I pulled my .45, pumped the slide to chamber around, and stuck it in the man's face. When he obeyed my command to lie on his stomach, I pointed my .45 into the air and inadvertently squeezed the trigger, discharging a round into the sky. It startled everyone and stopped the fighting so that we were able to get the suspects into handcuffs. By the way, I got a verbal commendation from the provost officer for my quick thinking. Since I had not received any commendation up to that point, I accepted his with grace and humility, never mentioning that it had been a mistake. Another standard safeguard is to hold the gun at a low port position, angled downward. Should there be an unintentional discharge, the round will hopefully strike the floor, or at least hit the lower portion of any individual unfortunate enough to be in front of the weapon. The greatest safeguard, however, is to not allow your heart rate to get too high. Calm people are much less likely to make these kinds of mistakes. Once your heart rate rises above condition red, generally beginning around 145 beats per minute, there is nothing there that you want. Most people have experienced anxiety before taking an important test. There are 2 components to test anxiety, the psychological and the physiological. The latter is characterized by an accelerated heart rate and a loss of fine motor control. When I was teaching at West Point and Arkansas State University, I found that football players generally suffered the worst from test anxiety. Now, on most campuses, the football players have an unfortunate reputation of being dumber than a box of rocks, as one of my fellow professors put it, which is generally unfair. The truth is that they are generally no less smart than any other athlete, but their sport can work against them. With the exception of the quarterback and the kicker, no one on the football team needs fine motor control. The blockers and the backers certainly do not need it, and most of the time the receiver, catching with 2 hands, only needs bilateral symmetry. When a football player is in the game, functioning in what is often referred to as his sweet spot, his performance level, his condition red, which may be pushed very high up into the gray zone, is somewhere between 140 and 175 beats per minute. An unfortunate byproduct of this is that because he performed in his sweet spot so often in middle school and in high school and now in college, his performance level heart rate can overlap to the classroom. He might have studied all night for a test. He knows the material and he is raring to go. But when he sits down to take it, his heart pounds in his chest just as it does on the field. He suddenly cannot get his fingers to operate his pen, and the harder he tries, the worse his condition gets. So he blanks. He cannot get even the first question, and he goes downhill from there. When he fails the test, everyone is convinced he is stupid, and, sadly, he may even believe it himself. But he is not stupid. It is just his body working against him. During my time as a professor at Arkansas State, most of the coaches tried to send their players through my introduction to psychology class. It was not because I'm an easy professor, but rather because I taught them a powerful breathing technique, the same one that I will give you later in this audiobook. I would watch the students as they took their test, keeping an eye out for cheating, but mostly I watched for signs of test anxiety. Often I could see them hunch their shoulders and hyperventilate. If they were light complexion, their faces would turn white around the nose and lips, and their knuckles would turn white. When this happened, I knew I had someone suffering from test anxiety. So periodically during the test, I would have them all stop and put their pencils down, and I'd say my mantra, "It's a free throw. It's a free throw." Then I would make the whole class do exactly what a basketball player does to prepare for a free throw. Breathe to lower the heart rate. More specifically, I have them do the 4-count tactical breathing exercise used by elite SWAT teams and special ops soldiers worldwide, and it worked. Tactical breathing is truly a revolution in warrior training, and I'm just one of many individuals teaching this technique. The Caliber Press Street Survival Seminar is a world-class program that has trained hundreds of thousands of law enforcement officers in this method, and they have received extensive feedback confirming that tactical breathing has undoubtedly saved many lives. If this technique can be useful for college basketball players in the heat of a game, and for football players contending with test anxiety, how infinitely more important is it for warriors making life and death decisions and taking life and death shots in the middle of the toxic, corrosive, destructive environment of the universal human phobia? Condition black. O judgment, thou art fled to brutish beasts, and men have lost their reason. Shakespeare, Julius Caesar. Bruce Siddle's heart rate research, Popular Science's reports of NASCAR drivers, and the Green Beret stress test research all indicate that 175 beats per minute is about as high as condition red can be pushed into this mysterious gray zone. Again, we must be cautious about putting specific numbers on these conditions, but it would appear that even under the most ideal circumstances, above 175 beats per minute, a catastrophic set of events begins to happen. Cardiologists tell us that at a certain point, an increased heart rate becomes counterproductive because the heart is pumping so fast that it cannot draw in a full load of blood before pumping it back out. As the heart rate increases beyond this point, the effectiveness of the heart and the level of oxygen provided to the brain steadily decreases. One cardiologist suggested to me that this might be what is happening when sympathetic nervous system arousal induces a heart rate above 175 beats per minute. Whatever the cause, something remarkable appears to be happening when the sympathetic nervous system accelerates the heart rate above 175 beats per minute. For our purposes here, let us call this condition black. And let's examine what is going on inside the mind of a person trying to function at that level. The triune brain model was developed by Dr. Paul MacLean, chief of the Laboratory of Brain Evolution and Behavior at the National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda, Maryland. He suggests that we think of the human brain as consisting of three parts: the forebrain, the part that makes you a human being; the midbrain, or mammalian brain, the part that all mammals have in common; and the hindbrain, or the brainstem. The forebrain performs basic thought processes. The midbrain performs extensive reflexive processes. And the hindbrain takes care of heart rate and respiration. If you were to get shot in the forebrain, you might survive the wound, since you can survive a lot of damage in that portion of the brain. In fact, until you were a young teenager, doctors could perform a hemispherectomy and remove half your brain, and you could still have a fully functional life. Severe damage occurs, however, when a bullet hits your midbrain, and should even a small caliber bullet enter your hindbrain, the intrusion would probably shut down your breathing and your heartbeat. As you enter into condition black, your cognitive processing deteriorates, which is a fancy way of saying that you stop thinking. About 2,500 years ago, Brasidas of Sparta said that fear makes men forget, and skill that cannot fight is useless. In condition black, you can run, and you can fight like a big, hairless, clawless bear, but that is about all you are capable of doing. Your forebrain shuts down in the midbrain, the puppy, inside. That part that is the same as your dog's brain reaches up and hijacks the forebrain. It is important to note that there is a tremendous difference between the performance impact of a heart rate increase caused by fear, i.e., the sympathetic nervous system flooding stress hormones into your body, and a heart rate increase caused by physical exercise. When your heart is pounding due to physical exertion, your face will usually be beet red, as every blood vessel dilates wide open to get blood to the muscles. But with a fear-induced heart rate increase, your face will usually turn white due to vasoconstriction. If there are extreme physical demands placed upon the body at the same time that the vasoconstriction is occurring, then these two processes apparently work against each other to cause a skyrocketing heart rate. We are not sure why this happens, but the current dominant theory is that the physical demands cause the body to scream for oxygen, while the vasoconstriction shuts down the blood flow that provides the oxygen, causing the heart to beat ever faster while achieving very little. I mentioned this earlier, but it bears repeating here in order to understand that using physical exercise to increase your heart rate is an excellent technique to simulate the effects of combat stress. But we must remember that the powerful physiological effects of someone trying to kill you are not something we can replicate in training, although for some force, paint bullet training, someone trying to hurt you, can come fairly close. Have you ever tried to have an argument or a discussion with a truly frightened or angry person? It cannot be done, because the more frightened and angry the person is, the less rational he is. This is because his forebrain has shut down, and his midbrain, the one like a dog's, is in control. In fact, you might as well try to argue with your dog. He might be intrigued by the experience, but it will not accomplish much. Nor will you accomplish much when trying to talk to a human being in this heightened condition. To connect with him, you must calm him down first. Art Wall and Christensen in Deadly Force Encounters give a classic example of this irrational behavior. Officer Peterson didn't hear the other officer's shotgun explode, or his partner's handgun fire, or even his own fire, but every shot fired hit the suspect. I went up on the guy, who slid down the side of his car into a seated position and kicked his Beretta away. Another officer picked up the gun as two others pulled the guy onto his stomach and handcuffed him. Peterson was hit with a rush of adrenaline greater than any synthetic pill could create. I went to the car phone and punched in my home number. I got the recorder, but I knew my boys were home, probably still sleeping. I screamed for someone to pick it up, and I kept screaming until it awoke my boys downstairs. When they answered, I screamed at them what had just happened, that I wanted to see them. I just needed to hold them. When they asked how they could get to me, I told them that my partner would come and get them. Peterson says the rush was so intense, so extraordinary, that it was almost like an out-of-body experience. The boys were not brought to the scene. Vasoconstriction, white with fear. I ain't got time to bleed. Jesse Ventura. Think of those cold mornings when your fingers are white and not working for you. This is an example of vasoconstriction caused by cold. It also happens as a result of stress. At its earliest stage, as you enter into condition red, starting around 115 beats per minute, you begin to experience a loss of fine motor control. In condition gray, beginning around 145 beats per minute, the average individual begins to lose complex motor control. But when your heart rate roars up into the realm of condition black, around 175 beats per minute, the effects of vasoconstriction become catastrophic. It is easy to detect this in a light complexion person, although it happens to everyone of every race, because you can see the skin turn white where the blood flow to the outer layer of his body is constricted. Specifically, the blood pumps from the heart through the arteries and then, at the pre-capillary stage, just before entering the capillaries, the blood flow constricts. At low levels of vasoconstriction, from cold or stress, only the little capillaries shut down, causing some loss of fine motor control. It happens to your fingers on those cold mornings, and it happens when you are under stress. As the vasoconstriction becomes more intense, the blood flow to the complex motor muscles begin to shut down. The blood pools into the body core and large muscle groups, and your blood pressure skyrockets. This increase in blood pressure is an important aspect of what is happening to your body. Research at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center suggests that systolic blood pressure is a much better indicator of stress than heart rate. The outer layer of your body becomes almost a layer of armor. And as long as an artery is not hit, you can take extensive damage without much blood loss. This is why surface wounds on the face and scalp tend to bleed more. In this region, the intake and output vessels are both close to the surface, so the ability of vasoconstriction to limit bleeding is less effective here. This appears to be a survival mechanism intended to limit blood loss in a combat situation. The price you pay, however, is a loss of motor control because when the muscles stop getting blood, they stop working. Eventually, there is going to be a backlash called vasodilation, which is the opposite of vasoconstriction. When vasodilation occurs, your veins go wide open, and if you are light complexioned, your face turns red. Police officers sometimes refer to this as a tomato face, and they have learned that it generally represents significantly less danger than the white face of vasoconstriction. Bruce Siddle gives a classic example of vasoconstriction. As three police officers check each other for injury after a shooting, one of them found a small pucker in the front of his upper sleeve, and another pucker on the other side. "The bullet must have missed me," he said, visibly relieved. But as soon as he uttered those words, the wound in his arm opened and the hole gushed blood. When he thought he was okay, he relaxed, which caused the vasoconstriction to stop and the vasodilation to begin. Another purpose for vasoconstriction. Among the many thousands of deadly force case studies that I have interviewed in my travels and presentations almost 300 days a year for 15 years now, a handful have mentioned that they didn't bruise while in combat survival mode. I began to wonder if vasoconstriction could protect you from bruising. And I asked a good friend of mine and a friend to all law enforcement, Todd D. Moldauer, M.D., an orthopedic spinal surgeon who has consulted for multiple law enforcement agencies in Southern California. This was his answer. The reduced bruising associated with trauma to a vasoconstricted extremity is very simple. Bruising, medically known as ecchymosis, is the presence of red blood cells which are no longer circulating in the vascular system and have leaked, extravasated, through damaged blood vessels into the surrounding tissues. If there is a large collection of blood, it's called a hematoma. Smaller accumulations, especially those due to blood vessel injury in the skin, spread through the loose connective tissue under the skin and cause the typical bruising that we're all familiar with. As the red blood cells break down over the ensuing days, the contents of the blood cells go through several stages of metabolic disintegration, which leads to the color change from blue to green to brown and ultimately restoration of normal skin color. The observation of reduced bruising in vasoconstricted extremities is due to the markedly reduced blood flow, volume of blood through the tissues. When there is reduced blood flow through the capillary beds, damage to those tissues releases a much smaller volume of red blood cells into the surrounding tissue, and therefore reduced bruising is seen. I tell my students in my classes, imagine stomping on a water balloon. Boom, it explodes. That is the veins and capillaries rupturing from blunt force trauma. Now, stomp on an empty balloon. Stomp on it all you want. Nothing happens. That is your veins and capillaries responding to blunt force trauma during vasoconstriction. Another amazing thing that the body is doing that we have just begun to understand. Dial 911. The midbrain has no philosophy, no hesitation, and no regret. It knows only death and life and nothing in between. The midbrain is never confused and never dithers. Its job is to get us out of this mess alive. It is poor at multitasking. It acts decisively and only does one thing at a time. It never apologizes, never looks back, and sheds no tears. Unfortunately, the midbrain is ignored in the training philosophy of many institutions. We do too much training in the abstract. In the abstract is where all training must begin, because the front brain is the entry point for all information. Unhappily, that is where much of what passes for training also ends. As the student is gradually immersed in the training environment, stress levels must be increased so that important psychomotor skills begin to filter into the midbrain. The midbrain will only know what to do if the student has been stress inoculated. John Farnham, correspondence to Colonel Grossman. As you grow increasingly stressed and move into condition black, it is common to lose your peripheral vision, a condition commonly referred to as tunnel vision. The more stressed you become, the more narrow the tunnel. There will also be a loss of depth perception, meaning that a threat looks closer than it really is, and a loss of near vision, meaning that you have trouble seeing close things. You literally become so scared you can't see straight. People facing a threat, such as a man with a knife, often back away to see more of the situation. It is a terrible irony in some stressful situations that at a time when you need your eyes the most, you may lose your near vision. So what does this loss mean? Consider the simple act of dialing 911 on your telephone. Allow me to give you an easy homework assignment, one that I implore you to do. Some night, while you and your family are watching television, disconnect your telephone and have everyone in your family practice dialing 911. Do it at least 20 times each, and do it several times a year. Why practice such a simple act? Say your child has never practiced dialing 911, and she is home alone in the back bedroom when someone is breaking down the bedroom door. Her terrified heart rate will probably be hammering at 220 beats per minute. Remember, her fine motor control began deteriorating at 115 beats, and her near vision began diminishing around 175 beats per minute. Now, at 220 beats, your child's life depends on her ability to dial three numbers she has never dialed before. If she has rehearsed it, her fingers will know what to do even at the accelerated heart rate. But if she has not rehearsed it, one police officer gave me an excellent example. "I'm kind of a lazy guy," he said. "I've never looked up a phone number in my life. I just dial 411. One day, while he was home alone, he accidentally shot himself in the leg. I dialed and dialed and dialed 911, but I kept getting 411. Since that is what he normally dialed, under stress, his fingers were on autopilot. I finally gave up," he said, "and told the information operator, 'I'm a cop. I've shot myself. Contact emergency for me.'" Whatever you rehearse is what you will do under stress. If you spend years and years dialing 411 and never practice 911, then under stress, you are likely to dial 411. In another case, an officer had to apply CPR on his infant daughter. He handed the phone to his wife and told her to dial 911, but she could not do it. Without prior practice, she could not see the numbers and she could not use her fingers even to save her own child's life. Another officer told me that his wife was home alone with the kids when the dog started barking, and someone began smashing down the kitchen door. She fumbled desperately with the telephone, but she could not see the numbers. She did manage to press the zero button, which ultimately saved their lives. An officer at a law enforcement training center suffered a heart attack, and as he lay dying, the administrative assistant tried in vain to dial 911. She dialed over and over, but could not get an emergency operator. Finally, in anger and frustration, she threw the phone across the room, ripping the cord from the wall. Later, when she was calm and collected, she realized she had not been dialing 9 to get an outside line. Whatever skill you require under stress must be rehearsed ahead of time. For example, if you're going to dial 911 on a cell phone, you must remember to hit send at the end. You know that now when you are calm and collected. But what about when your heart rate is racing at 220 beats per minute? Rehearse it now a few times so that it is there for you when you need it. Be sure the phone is turned off first. Police officers know that they have to rehearse changing magazines in their weapons. While it is easy to put a magazine in the well of a gun and slam it in tight, experienced officers know that if they have not drilled on this simple action, they might not be able to do it in a stressful situation. There is particular value in practicing skills under stressful training situations, such as during force-on-force paintball engagements. If warriors perform an action under survival stress, then they will truly own the skill in the midbrain. Loss of near vision and pistol marksmanship. As difficult as it may seem during the heat of the battle, it is important to shift your focus from the weapon itself to the living, breathing human being wielding the weapon. The same human being who eats, sleeps, urinates, and also puts his pants on one leg at a time, just like you did this morning. Steve Tarani and Damon Fay, Contact Weapons, Lethality and Defense. In a heart-pounding situation, the loss of your fine motor control and near vision makes it mandatory that you drill on those things that seem simple when you are calm and collected. In Sharpening the Warrior's Edge, Bruce Siddle notes that fine motor skill decreases as heart rate increases, but you can limit the impact by preparing mentally and physically ahead of time. With a loss in near vision, you may not be able to see your pistol sights. On a rifle, it appears that the front sight is far enough away that the ability to see it clearly is not affected by loss in near vision. And on a military peep sight, the rear sight is supposed to be out of focus. That may help explain why virtually all armies in all nations converted to the peep sight on their military weapons throughout the 20th century. There is no debate about the fact that this inability to focus on the pistol sight can occur, although there is an ongoing debate as to how to deal with the problem. Some say that if you are taught to see the front sight long enough and hard enough, you will see it at the moment of truth. Others say that should you suck up two slugs and your heart rate raises to 220 beats per minute, you cannot be expected to see your sights and you need to learn instinctive shooting, sometimes called target-focused shooting or point shooting. I don't want to get involved in this point shooting versus aim shooting debate. I have good friends, men I admire and respect greatly, on both sides of this issue, and I think we are probably evolving to a solution that uses a combination of the two methods. When you have time and distance, use those sights, but when you do not, at extreme close ranges, there may be value in reverting to point shooting. Just know that under extreme stress, you might not be able to see your pistol sights. There are several case studies of police officers reporting after the gunfights that because they could not see the sights, they did not fire. Know ahead of time that this phenomenon might happen, and don't let it paralyze you. If you find yourself in a desperate, life and death, point-blank confrontation, and you have a clear shot, trust your instincts, point, and fire. But if you're having difficulty focusing on your sights, and you have just a few seconds, breathe. Most of us were taught to breathe during our first day on the firing range, using the acronym BRASS, B-R-A-S-S, breathe, relax, aim, sight, and squeeze. Breathe in. Hold it. Let it out. Hold it and squeeze. This is a perfect opportunity to use the tactical breathing method. If you have the time, breathe and pull yourself down to condition red so you can get those sights in focus. Or take it a step further and pull yourself down into condition yellow and make a rock-solid precision shot. The breathing technique will be covered in greater detail later, but let me give you just one example of an individual who consciously used this technique to bring himself down into condition yellow. One officer told me of an experience he had while hunting. "I had this magnificent buck in my sights," he said. "I'm up in my deer stand, and my heart is pounding in my chest. It's a long shot and an awkward angle, and all I can see is the back of his head and neck. I have the time, so I take 4 deep belly breaths, just like you taught us. The breathing brought my heart rate down, and I made the shot." If a little breathing exercise can work in competition, on the range, and while hunting, know that it will have an enormous power to control your stress response during combat. Section 2. Perceptual distortions in combat, an altered state of consciousness. A friend asked me an impossible task. Describe pitched close combat in words. Impossible, because it is all-encompassing, six-dimensional, from the front, the left, the right, ricochets from the back, exploding shells from above, and shaking ground from below. One actually feels the combat in the body. It involves blurred vision from sweaty eyes, the acrid, choking smell of layers of gunpowder smoke, ear-bursting, horrific noises, the kinetic nerve vibrations from exploding mortars, hand grenades, and shells, the screams of humans, the cries of the wounded, the piercing whine of ricochets of bullets and shrapnel, hiding behind or stepping over bodies of perhaps someone you know, all at one time. No media can ever duplicate it. No mere words ever convey it. Thank God it only happened to me a few times. But once exposed to the heat of it, it welds you into a bonding, not only with friend, but foe, that no one else, no matter how close to you,